When women begin to participate more in the economy, good things happen.
Because greater participation of women in the economy results in higher economic growth, lower inequality, better economical outcomes, and therefore greater economic and financial stability for the country.
But in many countries around the world, women are held back, often by old, outmoded laws.
I'm Catherine Christofferson. I'm an assistant general counsel in the legal department of the IMF. I also oversee the work from the legal perspective with regard to fund governance, institutional work, and our relations also with members and other international organizations.
Catherine Christofferson is also one of the authors of some new research that looks at the legal barriers to women's economic activity and what triggers countries to reform those laws. Journalist Rhoda Metcalf sat down with Catherine Christofferson to learn more.
Your paper I found very interesting, and it talks about a wide array of different laws that affect women's participation in economies around the world. But I was interested to know, are there certain types of laws out there in the world that are really holding women back the most?
Yeah, it's true. There is a set of certain categories that we focused on are the ones that create the most hurdles for them.
Right.
Constitutional law, because the constitutions are the ones that establish the civil rights. Property law, because women need to have access to their own property and exercise their rights over the properties that they own in order to have access to economic empowerment.
Sure.
Family law is another very important area for us to focus on because, for instance, within family law, we have seen a lot of impediments with respect to inheritance and equal parental rights.
So in other words, women don't always have access to their children if the couple splits up.
Exactly. And even when they become widows, they cannot take care of their children. Sometimes they have to be under the authority or control or support of another male in the family.
Oh, so they don't even when the father dies, they don't always go to the mother. Then sometimes they stay in the father's side of the family.
Exactly. The other area that is extremely important for our research was labor law, right? Because it's very important to ensure that women have rights to employment and areas related to labor law like social security. And finally, another area that was very important for us to analyze was tax law. It is also because it's dear to my heart. I used to be a corporate tax lawyer in the past and a professor of law. But it's because of the effects that taxation have on women as second income earners and the penalization that you can find in that.
Right. So, I mean, what's the incentive for governments to make these reforms and what's in it for them?
Well, I think that it's an excellent question. And from the IMF's perspective, we believe that countries should care about addressing gender gaps and inequalities that impede women's economic empowerment, not only because this will tangibly support women's rights to their full participation in the economy, but also because greater participation of women in the economy results in extremely important positive economic outcomes for the country.
Nevertheless, you know, a lot of countries are slow to make these kinds of reforms. What finally pushes countries to take on reforming laws to give women more economic and political rights? I mean, what happens in a country that triggers this?
We have found, for instance, that a key trigger is political movements and political changes. In the case of the U.S., for instance, in the 1960s, there was this very important period of advancement of civil rights.
Right, civil rights movement.
Exactly, the civil rights movement. And there was a number of important pieces of legislation, including the Equal Pay Act of 1963 and Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which prohibits discrimination based on sex in the workplace, that all came into force around that time. More recently, another similar example is what happened during the Arab Spring in 2010 and 2011. In the case of Tunisia, for example, after the Arab Spring and the movement, there was a greater participation of women in parliamentary elections and later a revision to their constitution to embody the principle of equal treatment for all citizens, regardless of sex.
When women get more political rights, that often leads to more economic rights, right?
Yes, it's absolutely true. And not only on economic aspects, but in many other areas. I like to use the term of a virtuous circle, because when women who are affected by legal impediments or discrimination have the power and the authority to design ways to address those issues, the effectiveness of the reform, whether it's legal, institutional, regulatory, or just practices like in the private sector, the outcome is it's much more effective.
Which makes sense, of course, because once women have a greater voice, they tend to vote for even more rights for women, right?
Yes, right. Yes. Another example of a trigger for why countries introduce changes in these areas are definitely periods of war. This has been seen, for instance, in the case of Britain and France during the two world wars.
Right, after the world wars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in many other country cases that you have seen that the major reforms have come right after a period of war, whether it's internal or external.
And it's interesting, one of your case studies is Peru, and I know that you have personal experience in Peru. I was wondering whether you also think that the period of conflict in Peru led to reforms in that country, because now Peru is sort of one of the leaders, right, in Latin America in terms of reforms for women's emancipation.
Yeah, so thank you so much for asking a question about this particular case study, about which I have personal experience indeed. And it's very important to use Peru as a case study for many different reasons. The major reforms have started in the early 1990s. We were coming out of 12 years of a very difficult period, fight against terrorism in that era.
During the Sendero Luminoso, the Shining Path.
Exactly, the Shining Path and the MRTA, the other terrorist groups. What we have found in our research, so it's beyond my own personal experience, which I can attest to, is that the key legal institutional reforms were really starting following the approval or the adoption of the new constitution, the 1993 constitution. And the main reason is that this constitution, for the first time, enshrined key constitutional provisions establishing equality for all, the non-discrimination of persons based on sex, and the equality of employment and labor opportunities for all. So following this major constitutional reform, many other extremely important legal and institutional reforms were implemented subsequently. For instance, reforms to property law that ensured women's rights to inherit property, which helped them improve their bargaining power in the household, but also used those properties or assets for economic activities and for collateral to obtain credits. They changed labor laws also that provided maternity leave, prohibited gender discrimination in hiring.
But what led to that? I mean, what led to the decision to have a change in the Constitution and all these laws come out of it? I mean, what drove that?
Well, as I was referring to, we were coming out of a very difficult period in our history in Peru. Elements of inequality were always identified as one of the sources of the conflict.
Driving factors of the conflict.
Yeah, and inequality, the way to address them was not only by listing what the human rights are or equality of all before the law. It was also very important to change, for instance, the whole economic model of Peru was changed in 1993 to foster and promote property rights, private investment, foreign direct investment, that benefited the country in terms of obtaining economic growth and stability for many decades.
So it's kind of interesting, the idea that, you know, as fragile states enter a post-conflict period, there is an opportunity, a window for improvement in women's rights.
Yeah, absolutely. Because they are always unique opportunities to rebuild institutions, systems, and even their legal frameworks, right? After everything is destroyed or partially destroyed, and there is an impulse to rebuild everything. One of the examples that we like to use is Rwanda.
Right.
In the case of Rwanda, their progress in this particular area really came about after the country's 1994 genocide. And as a result, the 2003 Rwandan constitution enshrined the principle of equality between men and women and implemented a requirement that women should occupy at least 30% of positions in parliament, which have made a huge difference, as we were discussing before, because the more women participate in decision-making process at the highest level in the governments and in parliament, they are more focused on introducing changes to the areas that creates the most problems in terms of inequalities and gaps. And they have also in Rwanda made key legal reforms in areas related to property and labor force participation by establishing equal working conditions and wages.
Right.
As a result of all these reforms, you may know already that Rwanda has made important strides that have positioned it among the top 10 countries in the world in the WEF's 2021 Global Gender Gap Index.
Right. But changes in law alone don't always lead to significant changes on the ground. So what more is needed beyond laws in order to this actually turning into real change in women's situations in terms of the economy and their ability to participate fully?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Law reform becomes successful when there are also changes in the institutional frameworks that support the application of the law. For instance, when there are concerns for women to go to work, right? And we have seen in many countries where the legal impediments were actually removed, but there is still a very low level participation of women in the labor market. And when you try to figure it out, it's that women, when they go to work in some countries, they don't even have separate bathrooms for them,
right,
or there are no child care support. And that has always been a very important topic that we would like to stress when we're discussing these issues, because of the social, cultural norms or religious beliefs, they are expected to stay at home to take care of the kids. So it's not that the law is not helping, but it's going to take longer.
I guess also there could be some kind of a role for external organizations like the IMF to sort of incentivize or you know, push countries a little bit towards more real improvement in the economic participation of women. Is that happening at all, or do you think there could be more of that?
Yes, I think that it's already happening and we can do much more. But since 2015, we have become more systematic in trying to support countries also on gender-related aspects. Like, for instance, in India, the IMF recommended investing in transport to ease the transition from informal to formal employment of women. And in the case of Germany, which is an advanced economy, in 2015, the IMF highlighted the need for high-quality and affordable childcare. Because if it is not, if you have the childcare, but it's not affordable,
right,
when you do the cost-benefit analysis, the women may end up staying at home with the kids instead of sending them to childcare.
Right.
But looking forward, the IMF is trying to position itself even better to serve the membership better in terms of gender-related issues.
Okay.
The IMF, for the first time in history, has a gender advisor who is leading the work on gender-related issues at the fund. So the managing director appointed Ms. Ratna Sahai, who is a very senior and experienced economist with a very distinguished career at the fund as our gender advisor. And she's leading the work of our teams in developing a new gender strategy for the fund.
Does it make it a lot more high profile in that case?
Exactly. And in that same way, we in the legal department of the IMF, we are also expanding our work on gender you saw our paper. It's our first paper on gender issues from the legal perspective, and we try to convey how important it is to take this first step of legal reforms to eliminate impediments to women's economic empowerment and to incentivize their participation in the economy. And going forward, we are doing more of that.
Well, that's great. That's really interesting. So, Catherine Christofferson, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast today. This has been a really interesting conversation, and good luck with this work in the future.
Thank you for having me and having the opportunity to share with you the results of our paper. Thank you.
Catherine Christofferson is an assistant general counsel in the legal department at the IMF. She was speaking with Rhoda Metcalf. Look for the working paper on tackling legal impediments to women's economic empowerment at imf.org. And look for other IMF podcasts on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You can also follow us on Twitter at @IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards.
And I'm Rhoda Metcalf.
Thanks for listening.